love to know how he's going to do it. I mean, I know he's fit, but 7 marathons in 7 days, that's quite some undertaking, isn't it?
It really is. I mean, yeah, I don't know how him and his team do it, if I'm honest. And to say it's a little grey and overcast today is probably an understatement. I know the weather was pretty awful when they set off this morning. So I think, you know, just to add to the difficulty, he decides to do it in December. So, yeah, I think this is going to be some week.
He loves a challenge. But very quickly, a lot of people will have listened to this interview, will want to support Kevin Sinfield. How can they go about doing that?
Yes, absolutely. He has a Give As You Live page, so people can go on there and donate online. There are also ways to text to donate as well. Text Kevin 10 to donate £10 to what is an incredible cause, you know, working for the MND Association, being able to support the MND community and put more money into that vital research.
That's great. Thanks. If you missed any of those details, do listen to us on Catch Up. You can do that on the app. Thanks very much to Joe Coker, Director of Income Generation at the Motor Neurone Disease Association. Thank you very much to all of my guests today. That's it from me. I'll be back tomorrow with the Times at One. My producer was Lizzie Highfield and Ryan Boyden was pressing the buttons. Next on Times Radio, it's Fee Glover and Roy Anika.
On DAB digital radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Good afternoon, it's 2 o'clock and you're listening to Fee Glover and Roy Anika on Times Radio.
And coming up over the next 2 hours, the Prime Minister has backed his Chancellor then, saying she didn't mislead the public over the budget. What does the Times' Whitehall editor make of it all? We're going to head to Bangladesh as well this afternoon to assess how the news of London MP Tulip Sadiq's 2-year prison sentence has been received. And it is the 1st of December. Were you tempted to pop your Christmas jumper on this morning? Well, God wants you to, according to the Dean of Salisbury. We ask, really? And an update on a very important story. Escaped reindeer, cool buddy, lost in Formby, now back home safe.
But first the news with James Kitchen.
Thank you, Roy. Good afternoon. Sir Keir Starmer's insisted the Chancellor did not lie to the public when she said there was a black hole in the country's finances before her budget. The Office for Budget Responsibility says it told Rachel Reeves in advance the economic outlook was better than expected. The Conservative leader, Kemi Badenoch, says the Chancellor should resign and accuses her of giving false information. But in a speech in London, the Prime Minister backed his colleague, insisting it was a budget to be proud of. The Times' policy editor, Oliver Wright, says the government's been thrown off track by its own confusion.
It's difficult for the government because this speech was always due to happen. This speech hasn't been put in the diary as a result of the row with the OBR. But it was meant to be about selling the measures in the budget, about selling, you know, the cost of living measures, about selling what Starmer would say was a bold decision on child poverty. But, you know, it's been overshadowed.
The former minister, Tulip Sadiq, says she's the victim of a kangaroo court after being sentenced to 2 years in prison in Bangladesh. The Labour MP's been accused of obtaining land in the capital, Dhaka, by using her links to the ousted Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina, who's also her aunt. In an open letter last week, several lawyers warned that Sadiq had not had the opportunity to defend herself. The former Attorney General, Dominic Grieve, signed the letter. Speaking to Times Radio, he said the trial wasn't being pursued in a fair way.
As the information and the actual evidence has never been made available to her, even though it could easily have been provided to her in this country where she lives, after all, she can be reached at the House of Commons. It's impossible to say whether there is in fact any substance to this particular allegation at all.
Volodymyr Zelensky says there are tough issues to work out as negotiators continue to work through a peace deal to end the war in Ukraine. The country's president is meeting Emmanuel Macron in Paris before flying to Ireland. Earlier, 3 people were killed in a Russian missile attack on the city of Dnipro. Agency staff hired to cover bin workers on strike in Birmingham have now also walked out. The Unite Union claims the actions over allegations of bullying, harassment and the threat of blacklisting. Onay Kassab is the union's national lead officer.
They are being bullied. They are being harassed. They are being threatened with blacklisting. They are also being told to work unsafely. They're not being given the equipment needed to do the job. That's the personal protective equipment. And they're also being overloaded. They are being asked to do more than what is reasonable within a day.
Birmingham City Council strongly refutes claims of bullying, calling them unfounded. And Sir Salman Rushdie has said the shooting of the right-wing political activist Charlie Kirk in the US was an appalling act of violence.
I'm not in favour of people being murdered. I mean, I thought what everybody thought, but it seems to me to be a characteristic or a consequence, let's say, of America's terrifying gun culture.
The Indian-British author survived an attempt on his own life. He was repeatedly stabbed at an event in New York in 2022, blinding him in one eye. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on the Times radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB, online, and on your smart speaker. Afternoons on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms.
Thank you very much, James. Welcome to the 1st of December, 4 minutes past two. May all of your advent calendars contain perfect red robins. We know you're classy and you don't have massive blocks of chocolate behind each door. Or do you? Roy and Nika is with me today and tomorrow. Today we head through the afternoon considering all the turmoil about the OBR and the budget. The truth is that we might all be feeling better about ourselves and this country's future if we'd known what the Chancellor and the PM knew about what the OBR had told them before the budget came our way. And maybe like us, you're fed up of thinking all we've got is a tired old fiscal horse lamely dragging itself across the horizon of productivity. Maybe it would have been good to know that the workhorse has been picking up the pace. It matters. It's a real-world consequence. We'll know more by 2:30 this afternoon about the future of the OBR. Tulip Sadiq has been sentenced to a two-year jail sentence in Bangladesh. Keir Starmer stands by her here. We will consider that too. And not one but two Christmas stories for you today. Ho, ho. If we do another one on Wednesday, it'll be ho, ho, ho. We hear about the escape of Buddy the reindeer. Now, he made a run from it from a Christmas grotto on Merseyside. Who can blame him? He's been recaptured and is safe back in his reindeer stable now. We'll discuss that. And the Dean of Salisbury says that God would forgive us our silly, tasteless Christmas ways. So pop on your Christmas jumper, light up the outdoor Santa, get some new batteries in your antler headband and eggnog us all the way to 4 o'clock. Do you do a tasteless Christmas, Roy Nika? I cannot believe for a moment that you do.
I wouldn't say it's tasteless, but I have been known to don a festive Christmas jumper in the name of charity.
Okay.
To cheer up some children.
So you'll do it for a good cause.
I will do it for a good cause. I won't just do it for fun.
Do you have any lights that flash in your house or outside your house?
There is a Christmas tree with lights outside my block of flats. They don't flash. I would object to that.
Yes, I think everybody in your neck of the woods would object to
I don't
that.
Know what you mean?
But the Dean of Salisbury has made this lovely point that actually God really would embrace absolutely everything, and that includes the incredibly tasteless aspects of Christmas. So we'll talk about that with Kaya Burgess in a couple of moments' time. The most read stories on the Times website this afternoon. Number three, chaos and splits as Jeremy Corbyn's party rejects him as leader. Infighting marred your party's conference as members ditched a single leader model and installed a committee system to run the party for up to 21 months. The second most read story, Ellen and Portia fleeing the Cotswolds. My heart goes out to them, really. This is Kevin Maher on the Hollywood couple, possibly escaping from the country. And the most read piece on the Times website is Rachel Reeves' latest Keir Starmer defence budget in speech. You can read all of those articles on thetimes.com. You do need your digital subscription. If you don't have one, quite simply get one. Go to thetimes.com/subscribe. Our number this afternoon and every afternoon, 0333 003 2353. I think we'll take anybody's experiences of truly tasteless Christmases ahead of our interview about the Dean of Salisbury.
Now, Keir Starmer has emphatically backed his Chancellor, saying neither he nor Rachel Reeves misled the public over the UK's finances before raising taxes. The Prime Minister defended the budget at an event earlier today.
There was no misleading. And I simply don't accept, and I was receiving the numbers, that being told that the OBR productivity review means you've got £16 billion less than you would otherwise have had, shows that you've got an easy starting point. Yes, of course all the other figures have to be taken into account, but we started the process with significantly less than we would otherwise have had.
Well, ministers have also been voicing their anger to the Times, saying they feel they were misled too. Ben Clackworthy is The Times' Whitehall editor, and he joins us now. Ben, it's really bad news for the government, isn't it, that this is still a fiasco 5 days on from the budget? Just take us through what exactly this row centres on.
Yes, so the row centres on what Rachel Reeves did and didn't know in the run-up to the budget, and also what she chose and chose not to tell both publics and her, crucially, cabinet colleagues. Now, she took the extraordinary decision of having a press conference 3 weeks out from the budget, where she basically rolled the pitch for big tax increases. And at the centre of her argument was the fact that the OBR, the Office for Budget Responsibility, had looked at productivity in the UK over the last 10 years, and it had downgraded its assessment of that, leaving Rachel Reeves with money to find. However, what she chose not to say at that press conference was that higher inflation had meant that tax receipts were considerably up. And the last forecast she had received on the 31st of October, so 4 or 5 days before that press conference, was that actually she was in the black, albeit by only a couple of billion pounds, but she was in the black. And yet she was telling the public that everyone would need to do more to shore up the nation's finances.
Ben, why? It sounds like a similar question, but why did she keep telling people there was a black hole? Given what we've just heard you in that brilliant summary, why did she keep telling people ahead of the budget there was a black hole? What was the point of that?
Well, one of the reasons that she argues is that that assessment did not take into account the U-turn on welfare spending, and it also was by a far too small margin for what is the fiscal headroom. Now, in the autumn last year, she left herself about £10 billion. That proved to be too small. She wanted to increase that amount of headroom. That means that if there are external shocks, for example, energy prices or trade tariffs and trade wars, that the UK is insulated from those effects. However, that is very different to the proposition that was there at the time. She was implying that the OBR's productivity forecast had presented a huge black hole. That was not true. That had been mitigated against. What was true was that the welfare U-turn needed to be accounted for, and also any plans that she had in the budget, plus increasing the fiscal headroom. And the reason the budget went down quite well with Labour MPs last week is because we know that it was a spend budget, a tax and spend budget, spend on welfare and a smorgasbord of new taxes. And that's where the issue is, because cabinet ministers and MPs feel that they did not know that actually all the money that was raised was to increase welfare spending by 16 billion, but also to just put in a bit of extra headroom.
And government ministers, some government ministers are quite cross about how this has all played out. What have they been telling you, Ben?
Well, what we've been hearing is that they felt, like the public, that they had been misled in some way, that they were told that the public finances were in dire straits. Privately, people were saying they were told there was 20 to 30 billion pounds in this black hole that needed to be filled. And that was at the point at which she made that extraordinary press conference at the beginning of November. Now, actually, the government argued that they did not mislead during that press conference, that actually, when you look at the other facts that I mentioned, the U-turn on welfare plus the need to increase the headroom, that there was nothing misleading about it. What there is, though, and what people are angry about, is the fact that the full facts were not presented. It was doom and gloom, when actually the OBR forecast showed that there was some positivity in the figures. And also the other thing that opposition MPs are pointing to is the fact that both her and Keir Starmer had said that they would put country first, party second. And they say that that was a budget purely aimed at putting party first and quieting the unease on the back benches in order to buy themselves more time. And I think there's still a feeling here in Westminster that the May elections will be the sticking point for both, Starmer and Reeves.
I mean, on that point, we had Rachel Reeves out yesterday doing the media rounds, looking a little bit shaky in quite a few interviews. We've had Keir Starmer forced effectively to come out today to defend her and defend this budget and, you know, say that they didn't lie, they didn't mislead the public and their own ministers. How much political danger do you think this fiasco has left her in? And has it threatened Keir Starmer's position too?
Well, the two of them are intrinsically linked. And the fact that Starmer came out, as you say, really an unusual move. And actually, yesterday, we were really being told that it was to shore up the budget, to go out and try and sell some of those measures, some of those giveaways that they feel were actually lost in the fallout of the budget. The help with energy bills, although that's going to be negligible when you take in the fact that there are new green taxes that are going to push up bills higher, but also the freeze in rail fares, for example, and some of the other measures that they announced on Wednesday. They feel they got lost. Part of the reason that Starmer will want to go out and defend the budget staunchly and in a very headmastery way, he told the pupils, the assembled journalists, that there had been no misleading. And that is because he knows, as well as she does, that the two of them are absolutely linked. And if one goes, the other will have no ability to hang on. The question, though, is what the mood of the Parliamentary Labour Party will be going into Christmas, but then in the run-up to the elections. It is worth saying, though, that the process for disposing of a leader in the Labour Party is far harder than it was for the Conservatives, so we wouldn't see a return to that sort of chopping and changing of leader that we saw in the latter days of the Conservative administration.
Extraordinary, really, to already be speculating about chopping and changing prime ministers this early into the Labour government. But that is Ben Clatworthy, The Times' Whitehall editor.
Two very different opinions from two very different Pauls. Paul in Edinburgh says, good afternoon. Rachel Reeves has constantly accused the Tories of talking the UK down. We now know she's been doing so and, best case scenario, knowingly misleading, to break their manifesto pledge on tax. She should resign. But another Paul says, am I the only one who thinks the discussion around Reeves is an absolute non-issue? It's the budget that matters and that would be identical, irrespective of what was or wasn't said in the run-up. By all means, criticise the budget itself, but I don't know anyone who cares about this story and I think the journalists pushing it just need to move on. 0333 003 2353 is our WhatsApp this afternoon. We are going to move on, all Pauls, to talk about tasteless Christmases. So can you tick any of these boxes? And I'm going to ask Roya in the studio to participate in this off-the-cuff quiz. Chocolate-filled advent calendars?
No.
Pillowcases, not stockings?
No.
Outdoor Christmas lights?
Never.
Flashing lights?
Never.
LED lights?
Not so much.
Jumpers with antlers?
Occasionally for charity.
Actual spending on gifts?
Yes.
Online shopping on Christmas Day?
Never.
Okay, so you are so full of taste and we knew that. You're listening to Fee and Roya here on Times Radio until 4 o'clock this afternoon with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
John Pienaar on Times Radio, telling the stories that matter.
We're talking about nothing less than the definition and redefinition of America. That's not overstating.
Expert analysis and well-informed discussion.
If there is violence, and these fans are known for it, well, someone is going to have to answer for that afterwards.
And diverse opinion.
I guess I can understand the intentions behind this, but I've never quite been able to understand why the police had to be involved at all.
John Pienaar, a drive, this afternoon from 4 on Times Radio.
For people living with dementia, Christmas can be confusing, overwhelming, heartbreaking. Families are often left to cope alone. But you can help a family reimagine Christmas. Donate to Alzheimer's Society and you can help provide practical support, expert advice and crucial companionship this Christmas. It will take a society to beat dementia, and we can't do it without you. Search Alzheimer's Society and donate today.
A national book token gives a world of discovery, where imaginations run wild with endless possibility. They might choose a voyage to stars and black holes, or to relive their team's most legendary goals, to learn how to draw, to grow, to bake, or scare themselves silly and stay wide awake. From the depths of love to the depths of the ocean, give a gift beyond words. Give a national book token. Buy now for Christmas in bookshops everywhere. and online.
Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
As you know, I'm more of an expert on rap than I am on the markets.
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee delve a bit further into the day's news and give their views on all the hot topics of the day.
Let's not accuse anybody at this stage in the game. Or should we?
No, let's not.
Unencumbered and off air.
I don't think that we should spend too long
talking about that night when I wasn't there. Oh no, I'm going to bring it up.
Off Air, the podcast, now available on the Times Radio app.
Listen to Times Radio on your smart speaker. Just say, play Times Radio.
Afternoons on Times Radio with Wix Bathrooms. The free bathroom design service includes a home visit. So when you're ready to plan your new bathroom, let the Wix experts measure up for you. Get started by booking a free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Tracy, thank you. We're off. Tracy has furnished us with a tasteless Christmas experience. Many years ago, when I was free and single, I was playing the piano in a Christmas concert. I popped quickly to the loo, stepped on stage, bowed, turned and sat down ready to play. The seat felt a bit cold because the hem of my skirt had been tucked into my pants. I wondered why the audience so gasped. I never played there again, though I did accidentally set fire to a piano a couple of years later. Tracy, what a life, darling. Thank you for that. I think we need to know more about accidentally setting fire to the piano a couple of years later. Maybe we could put that in the second hour of our programme. We will take any kind of tasteless Christmas experience this afternoon to cheer us up. It is a really grey and dismal first day of the December month here in London. So stay warm and toasty and vaguely amused with us on Times Radio.
News now of an exciting competition on Times Radio in association with Thomas Fudges, who makes some of Britain's finest biscuits. This Christmas, you could celebrate Christmas in style with a Yuletide trip you'll never forget. We're giving you the chance to win an enchanting three-night Christmas getaway for two in either Vienna, Prague or Copenhagen. This delicious experience includes flights, luxury hotel accommodation, dinner and £500 spending money. For your chance to win something extra special, thanks to Thomas Fudge's biscuits, simply go online and search for Times Radio Competitions. You'll find the entry form on our website. One entrant will be selected at random from all valid entries, and the competition closes at midnight on Sunday, December the 14th. All the terms and conditions are online. Good luck.
That is a decent prize. Now, if you're planning to rock a ridiculous Christmas jumper at upcoming festive parties, fear not. The Dean of Salisbury says that God will forgive you, even if the fashion police won't. The Reverend Nicholas Papadopoulos claims God is tasteless and doesn't make aesthetic judgments. It's all in a new booklet he's written on the 12 joys of Christmas. Joining us to unwrap this theological take, very well done, is Kaya Burgess, religious affairs correspondent for The Times. Hello, Kaya, how are you?
Good, thank you. How are you?
Yes, very well indeed. I'm excited that we're now in the run-up to Christmas. I haven't got my Christmas jumper out quite yet. Have you?
No.
You know what? After writing this story, I think today might be the day a little bit later.
Okay. promises. Tell us a little bit more about what the Dean is claiming here.
Well, it was a great quote to see the Dean saying that he was describing God as tasteless. And I thought suddenly, you know, God had been cracking terrible jokes or something. But it turns out the point he was making was that, you know, he says God doesn't have a sense of taste in terms of preferring one style over another, one sort of aesthetic over another. And the Dean made quite the amusing idea that, you know, if you've got a Christmas jumper on and it's got fairy lights and, you know, a reindeer and unicorns and goodness knows what else, that seems to have absolutely nothing to do with the Christian story of the Nativity, that can still bring joy. And his argument was that's sort of the entire point of Christmas. And you don't have to feel that, you know, everything aside from the holy sort of worship and celebration of Jesus's birthday is that all you're allowed to do at Christmas, all those trimmings, including two examples I like were gaudy Christmas jumpers and innuendo-filled pantomimes, apparently both have the church's blessing.
Is this going to rather upset traditionalists?
I mean, yeah, upsetting traditionalists, I guess, is a bit like shooting fish in a barrel sometimes. There will be somebody who will find a way to be offended by this, I'm sure. But, you know, we've seen it for a long time. We've seen bishops and priests sporting Christmas jumpers covered in reindeer, and the sky hasn't fallen in. So I think people will probably cope.
Yeah. Is it also a realistic and therefore quite sensible attempt to be a bit more embracing towards the modern participants in Christmas who may think, I won't go to church because actually church does seem to be a bit more austere than my own Christmas celebrations?
Well, I think that's a very good point, although you'll notice if you look at how many people attend church on an average Sunday, those figures are quite low, but it does go up at Christmas. There are a lot of people who make their one and only trip to church around Christmas. I wrote an article over the weekend about how we all get driven bonkers by Christmas pop songs, and Mariah Carey comes for us earlier every year, and yet even people who are not religious find some sort of sense of joy and ritual in Christmas carols even. And so I think there is a sense in which, yeah, being able to embrace everything around that and realise that you're not going to have a finger wagged at you for saying, well, that's not strictly the meaning of Christmas, is it? That there is joy around it, whether that's going to the panto or wearing your ridiculous jumper, is probably quite a good idea.
And the possibility for tacky has always been there, hasn't it? If you look at the gifting of gold, frankincense and myrrh, I mean, you can see basically all of those things on special offer at Debenhams at Christmas if you want to.
There is literally a section in this new booklet which did make me laugh, where it talks about unwanted gifts, those presents that you're given and you haven't quite got the heart to say, why on earth did you get me this? This isn't going to suit me. Or so you say thank you very much, and then you think, oh, do I feel bad taking this to the charity shop on the 7th of January? But actually there's a certain joy to it. And the Dean of Salisbury even said, I'm not sure what a newborn baby in a stable in, you know, Bethlehem was going to do with certainly frankincense and myrrh, at least. I suppose the gold might have come in handy. But it was symbolic, and you know, it was that point of the gift being given, a sort of sacrificial offer from the wise men, and therefore it still had a value, even if perhaps a newborn infant didn't have immediate use for myrrh at that particular time.
Is the Dean of Salisbury one to watch in the hit parade of deans and other ecclesiastical figures, Kaya?
What, in terms of, you know, future greatness, you mean? Or?
Yes, yep.
It's possible. Deans are very interesting. Cathedrals are very interesting because they're hugely independent. I mean, the church is a whole mishmash of all these different very independent parishes and dioceses. But cathedrals particularly do their own thing. They sort of don't pay much attention to the bishops or the archbishops. And so being a dean is quite a good opportunity to sort of express yourself without really there being anyone above you. So if you make a name for yourself and people sort of warm to you, there's no reason why they couldn't think that a senior bishop posting certainly could be something they would do in future. It is a well-trodden path from being a dean to being a bishop over the years.
And we have a new Archbishop of Canterbury in time for Christmas this year, don't we? Would you expect to be seeing something different? Oh, not in post yet?
No, so there will be a ceremony on the 28th of January, which is when...
Okay.
So Sarah Mullally is still the Bishop of London until the 28th of January. It's called the... confirmation of election ceremony at St Paul's. So she'll be doing her sermons in London as the Bishop of London for Christmas, and we'll be getting a Christmas message from I think the Archbishop of York, who is still the sort of the caretaker until the new year.
Right, don't the wheels turn slowly sometimes?
Well, normally it's not a problem because the outgoing Archbishop is usually still in post, and then there's a sort of straight handover of the baton, but you'd think it might have been done a little bit more quickly given that the post will have been vacant for more than a year. But no, they do these things in their own time.
Yeah. Kaya, it's lovely to talk to you. Do send us a photograph of you when you've got your Christmas jumper on. Obviously, Roya and I, we remain disappointed. We were very much hoping
very
to see some flashing antlers or some angel wings.
It's Father Christmas like attached to a rocket, which I think is, you know, the meaning of the season.
We'll hold you to that, Kaya.
So that's, that fits the brief, doesn't it, of being a science correspondent and a religion correspondent.
Exactly. I try and toe that line all the time.
It's been combined beautifully in probably polyester. It's lovely to talk to you, Kaya. Thank you very much indeed. Kaya Burgess is our religious affairs correspondent for The Times. And I know that Christmas is just such a period of joy for people who are true believers, and we don't want in any way to be kind of taking the mickey out of it at all. But also there will be so many people who will think, well, this is great to have a dean who's going, bring it all in, bring all of the stuff that you enjoy about Christmas, and every family's got their idiosyncrasies. We've all got bits of tack and whatever that we bring out every year. Bring it with you into church rather than thinking I've got to leave it all behind and go somewhere else and feel different. You know, there are just too many people who have that distinction in their lives, don't they?
Totally agree. Do you have a re-gifting cupboard fee?
Massive, yes. Yeah. Well, it's sometimes with stickers on the bottom of the gifts just to make sure I don't give them back to the person who's gifted them to me.
That is very, very organised.
Yeah, it is very organised indeed. And also we do have a lot of tack. in our house as well. So our Christmas decorations on the tree have quite often just been things that have made us laugh during the year that we've turned into Christmas decorations. Some of them I won't even mention on the radio, but they definitely don't fit that kind of, I don't know, Dickensian Victorian ideal of Christmas at all.
I'm good. That's exactly what
they're rubbish.
Would be like. Excellent.
Right, we are going to talk just a little bit about Off Air, the podcast. Jane Garvey is not with us for today and tomorrow. She is dealing with some other stuff. She hopes to be back on Wednesday. It doesn't mean, though, that you can't get the Off Air podcast. That will drop tomorrow, as usual. There is usually an episode available every Monday to Thursday. It's where you can hear our 3:30 interviews in full, including recently Louise Penny, Petula Clark and Lady Glenconner. And last week we spoke to Dame Susan Langley, the Lady Mayor of London. She told me where she thinks London is right now with its financial services industry.
I'm incredibly positive about the UK. I think in Britain we're very, very good at saying what we're not good at, but we are very, very bad at saying what we are good at. So I think the city in London is unrivaled in terms of the ecosystem that surrounds all of our businesses, all the support services, legal, finance. And I think if you look at, there was a recent survey, I think it was CBRE, about the number of deals over 100 million that had come into the city. I think it was zero last year and it was up to 6 this year when the report was run. There's a lot of confidence and there's a lot of support for the city. But I think one of our problems is we don't talk it up, we talk it down, and that's just wrong. So over the next year, I intend to be far more Tigger than Eel.
Well, talking it down does seem to be a bit of a theme at the moment, doesn't it? That is Dame Susan Langley. You can download that episode and many, many others wherever you get your podcasts from.
Coming up, a Labour MP is convicted of corruption in Bangladesh, but she says it's trial by media. First, it's news with Tom Kitchen.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Good afternoon, James Kitchen with the news headlines. The Prime Minister's insisted the Chancellor did not lie to the public when she said there was a black hole in the country's finances before the budget.
There was no misleading, and I simply don't accept, and I was receiving the numbers, that being told that the OBR productivity review means you've got £16 billion less than you would otherwise have had shows that you've got an easy starting point.
The Office for Budget Responsibility says it told Rachel Reeves the economic outlook was better than expected. Sir Keir Starmer says he's proud of the budget, which he claims will lift hundreds of thousands of children out of poverty. Tulip Sadiq says she's absolutely baffled after being sentenced to 2 years in Bangladesh in prison for corruption. The Labour MP, who says she won't be resigning, was investigated after her aunt Sheikh Hasina was ousted as Prime Minister there. Flooding in southern Asia has killed more than 1,000 people, with hundreds still missing. The devastation across Sri Lanka, Indonesia and Thailand has been caused by cyclones and extreme weather last week. Agency staff covering for striking bin workers in Birmingham are also joining the picket line. Unite's alleging reports of bullying and harassment, which Birmingham City Council says are unfounded. And the English Football League's handed Sheffield Wednesday a further 6-point deduction for multiple breaches of regulations. They were hit with a 12-point deduction in October and are at the bottom of the championship on minus 10 points. And in the past few minutes, the Office of US Trade Representatives has said the US has agreed to exempt UK origin pharmaceuticals, pharmaceutical ingredients and medical technology from certain tariffs. And for a news bulletin, when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio.
We travel to explore, to learn, to connect. At Viking, we believe travel should be more than just a trip. It should be a doorway to cultural insight and personal enrichment. Our itineraries are designed to help you explore and engage with your destination through its food, culture, and customs. Start planning your river, ocean, or expedition journey today. Viking, exploring the world in comfort. Learn more at viking.com.
A national book token gives a world of discovery, where imaginations run wild with endless possibility. They might choose a voyage to stars and black holes, or to relive their team's most legendary goals, to learn how to draw, to grow, to bake or scare themselves silly and stay wide awake. From the depths of love to the depths of the ocean, give a gift beyond words. Give a National Book token. Buy now for Christmas in bookshops everywhere and online.
Afternoons on Times Radio with Wickes, the experts in kitchens. Choose Wickes for your new kitchen and then sit back and relax, knowing it's filled with products that are reassuringly backed up with guarantees. Book your free design appointment at wickes.co.uk.
John Pienaar takes over from us at 4 o'clock this afternoon. John, we've had a couple of messages so far on the afternoon show from people saying, look, the budget story, just move on from it. This is kind of doing cat's cradle in my head. It's not that important. But actually, we've had so many messages from people with their personal interpretation of the budget, suggesting that it's massively important. That time in the run-up to the budget, when we could have been told something different, it is a time when people cashed in parts of their pensions, took out a new mortgage deal, looked at the financial horizon, thought one thing and are now finding out the other. And that's the true pain, isn't it?
Well, no one's going to win this argument. I mean, the fact is, yes, clearly the Chancellor could have told the Cabinet and then the country more than she did in the run-up to the budget. I have to say, Chancellors do it their own way. And I can't think of many Chancellors, or any, frankly, that would go into minute detail on the fiscal forecast ahead of a budget and the way that it's been suggested that Rachel Reeves should have done. I mean, Gordon Brown certainly didn't. He wouldn't even tell Tony Blair what he was up to, let alone the rest of the cabinet. But maybe the bigger problem here is that a number, multiple, plural ministers, some in the cabinet, are joining in the chorus of criticism, saying that Rachel Reeves could and should have done more. And had she done so, then there'd have been more of a debate in the cabinet, there'd have been more suggestions about what to do in the budget. And you can be, you know, sceptical about any or all of that, but a worry is that that is what's being said by a number of cabinet ministers. And you've got now the Chancellor this morning getting the Prime Minister coming in behind her, saying he knew what she knew, no one was misled. But it is a little bit like being thrown a lead-lined life belt, because the Prime Minister, his popularity, if anything, is worse than Rachel Reeves. So the wind is blowing hard against them, and that's the politics of the moment.
Who have you got on this afternoon?
So I'm going to be talking to Douglas Alexander. He is the Secretary of State for Scotland. He was in that cabinet meeting, getting briefed. I don't doubt he's going to be defending Rachel Reeves. He was a great, like Rachel Reeves, he was a supporter of Gordon Brown, but his job requires him to, and I'm sure he probably believes it, that it's right that Rachel Reeves did it the way that she did it. But I want to ask him, you know, a good number of questions about that. I've got a former Brown advisor as well, Michael Jacobs, and I'm going to be looking at the leak of that report, talking to Kieran Martin, who's the former head of the National Cybersecurity Centre. One or two other really interesting stories, like the NATO commanders saying it's time to go on the front foot against Russia, who keep on hitting this country and others with cyber attacks. It's time to give them some of that back. I'm going to be talking to Ben Hodges, former US general who commanded the US Army. And on Venezuela and the attacks on boats in the Caribbean, some in Washington on both sides. And I'm saying I'll be looking at war crimes here, but I'm going to be talking to Charles Kupchan, who's a former senior director for the US National Security Council.
John, thank you very much. John takes over from us at 4 o'clock here on Times Radio.
Now, the former minister, Tulip Siddiq, has been sentenced to 2 years in jail in Bangladesh. She's been convicted in her absence of corruption. The Labour MP has denied the allegations and described them as malicious.
I'm absolutely baffled by the whole thing. I've still had no contact whatsoever from the Bangladeshi authorities, despite them spreading malicious allegations against me for a year and a half now. I've tried to be responsible. I've engaged lawyers here in the UK who have repeatedly written to the Bangladeshi authorities, but they haven't responded. I then tried to engage a lawyer in Bangladesh itself who went and tried to find out what was happening in court. They intimidated him and threatened him, and he withdrew. I then wrote to the leader of Bangladesh currently, who is Professor Mohammed Yunus, when he came to London, who has said publicly a few times that I'm guilty and had tried to smear my reputation. So I said to him, OK, let's sit down, let's have a coffee and let's talk about what I've done wrong, because I know I haven't done anything wrong. He declined to meet me. So there's been absolutely no summons sent to me. There's no charge sheet. I've had no correspondence from them. I'm not difficult to find. I'm a parliamentarian. All they had to do is send some papers to the House of Commons, to Parliament, and I would have responded. So I feel like I'm in some sort of Kafka's nightmare where I'm carrying on doing my day job, but on the other hand, I'm apparently being convicted in Bangladesh, and the only reason I know I'm being convicted is because I read it in the newspapers. So this is trial by media, which is deeply unfair.
Tulip Sadiq was found guilty of influencing her aunt, Sheikh Hasina, the country's former prime minister, to illegally secure a plot of land for her family in the suburbs of the capital, Dhaka. Ashfaq Zaman is the founder of CNI News Network, and he joins us from Bangladesh. Ashfaq, can you tell me, how serious were the charges against Tulip Sadiq?
I think on the greater context of what's happening over here, because there are also charges on human rights violation, where her aunt, the former prime minister, got a life sentence. So in the greater scheme of things, this probably is not the most intense of cases, because this is a case of corruption for a land which was declared to be illegally actually bought or taken possession of. And the due process was not being followed. And one of the names of one of the property owner's names was Tulip Siddiqui. And the sentence was 2 years of jail. So in the greater context of what's happening in the country, all the trials and the verdicts that's going on, probably this is not taking the main, at least on the local level, it is not one of the biggest things that has happened in the recent past.
Can I ask, we heard there from Tulip Sadiq saying she has repeatedly tried to engage with the Bangladeshi authorities and government on this case, and that she claims she's had absolutely no response from any of them, either through her lawyers here or the lawyers she's engaged in Bangladesh. Is there any indication as to why they have not responded to her, as she claims?
First of all, I'm not in the position to say whether that's valid or not. I think the court probably and the prosecutors probably will be in the better position to say. But I think one important thing to note over here is that for us or for the court, she is not a British MP. She is not here convicted as a British MP. So her privileges, as she was mentioning, that there was no letter being sent in the House of Commons and other places, probably is not valid, because at the end of the day over here, she's just a regular citizen. And I think the due process that would have been followed for being a regular citizen over here probably was followed. I'm sure she has a local identity as well, or I'm not sure whether she has a Bangladeshi passport. So in that context, probably the court has taken the proceedings. Having said this, I would also add that I think a lot of talk is going on because she representing the as a British MP. But corruption isn't about personality. It's a structural disease. And I think the verdict today is seen not simply as a punishment of individuals, but sort of like a test for the institutional capacity of Bangladesh to handle corruption, regardless of one's political lineage or global connections.
Is that something that people in Bangladesh or in the global sort of community have felt that Bangladesh have struggled with, handling issues of corruption?
I think so. This is a struggle that has been going on for quite some time. The pious wish is that we come out of such problems of the past, and we basically put our faith on and public trust on the institutions. We are trying to explore a new beginning of public honesty, where we believe justice is not only necessary, but justice without fairness becomes another form of injustice, and corruption always aids to that. So we are trying, not sure how much we could achieve, but it gives a clear message that we are not only focusing on or being intimidated by the big names. The public institutions probably needs to gain their position in such matters.
What has been the response from people within Bangladesh to the events leading up to this case, the trial and the sentencing?
As I mentioned earlier, I think the main focus is basically the what happened during the July and the mass killings, and all those issues are actually the main priorities at this point of the time. People are more concerned about the crimes against humanity and the trials related to that. I think other corruption cases, when it comes to general people, they're not giving this as much as focus as they probably will give towards seeking justice for the July movement and the people who have been injured or people who have been killed during the July movement. That is the main focus. Having said that, of course, Tulip Siddiqui being one of the British MP, that has also resonated in the news over here. and people are trying to see whether I think the common process over here, perception over here, is to see whether someone can influence a verdict or not because of their global standing or the global connection. And also, I think the civil society over here, they also do not feel that, you know, this verdict should, I mean, the political profile of Chilu Siddiqui should neither act as a shield nor target her. If there's ample evidence which was proven in the court, then that should actually lead to the verdict. If she has a complaint, and I think there's still avenues to follow the legal matters, make an appeal, both in the local court, and she can also reach out to the UNHRC if she feels that she has been a target of political aspects. So she can, of course, reach out to the Asian Human Rights Council. She can reach out to the UNHRC. She can also follow the due process as per the global standards.
I mean, can I ask finally, Ashfaq, you obviously, she is a British citizen and she is an MP here. Realistically, is there any way for the Bangladeshi government to make her actually serve this 2-year sentence?
Practically, I don't think so. This, as I mentioned, that this is more of understanding whether our court and our legal system is functioning in a fair way or not, whether they have the capacity to stand against corruption. So this is, I believe that, you know, if you have a case, you have to do the due diligence, you have to give the ruling. Whether the sentence or the punishment is actually being carried or not, that's a separate discussion. And on that context, we feel that maybe this is not something that can be applied right away, because that's also the same case with her aunt, who's also in India at this point of the time. But that doesn't mean that the justice or the legal system should stop. That should carry out. The verdict should go regardless.
Well, that was Ashfaq Zaman, the founder of CNI News, joining me from Dakar.
It's coming up to 3:15. On the subject of Christmas, Will says there's a whole Christmas book publishing category that exists to be gifted last minute in desperation while men wander around Waterstones. Ranulph Fiennes and Jamie Oliver owe much to this short but fast-shifting pathway from bookshop island near the door to discounted, stickered ignominy beside the Tesco Express lunchtime snack fridge. That's a beautiful text, isn't it? More of those, please. It's 0333 003 2353. Serious topics too. A couple of text and messages about the fate of Chulip Siddiq. Mark says the Bangladeshi court is a distraction. What is relevant in the UK is that an anti-corruption minister forgot who gave her a house. That would be an offence in the UK. We will keep all of those coming. Tracy has been back in touch to tell us how she set fire to a piano. We'll save that for the next hour of the programme. And in a couple of moments' time, it's trouble at the North Pole. Rudolph's escape. Well, that's not quite true, actually. That's a terrible exaggeration of the story. It happened in Formby, and the reindeer was called Buddy. But it is a runaway reindeer story, and it is December the 1st. So that is what we're going to go to. This is Fee Glover and Ryan Neeker on Times Radio Today with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Times Radio Breakfast with Nationwide. Start your day with Times Radio's essential morning briefing. With intelligent conversation and incisive analysis from some of the most respected names in politics, culture and entertainment. Hear well-informed opinion and quality journalism on all the big stories making the headlines. Times Radio Breakfast, tomorrow morning from 6, with Nationwide, a good way to bank.
Download the free Times Radio app from the App Store or Google Play today. For people living with dementia, Christmas can be confusing, overwhelming, heartbreaking. Families are often left to cope alone. But you can help a family reimagine Christmas. Donate to Alzheimer's Society and you can help provide practical support, expert advice and crucial companionship this Christmas. It will take a society to beat dementia, and we can't do it without you. Search Alzheimer's Society and donate today.
This Christmas, McDonald's and the Elf on the Shelf are bringing festive tasks to your little ones, like writing a Christmas card for your postie.
Thank you. You're one happy helper.
Some fun, some food, it's all inside this Happy Meal. Until the 30th of December, from 11 a.m, includes one pre-selected book or toy, while stocks last, subject to availability, fair ordering policy applies.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover, on Times Radio.
Not
Well, there was only ever going to be one tune for the story. A runaway reindeer called Buddy sparked an unusually large search operation on Merseyside at the weekend, even involving the Royal Marines. The poor, exhausted creature was eventually found sleeping on sand dunes several hours after bolting from a Christmas celebration event in Formby. I've been talking to Charlie Maloney, a journalist who writes for The Times, to find out more about what happened.
So essentially, there's a Santa's Grotto called Santa's Enchanted Forest in Formby in Merseyside. And they've got all the usual kind of Santa's Grotto treats, you know, marshmallow roasting, elves dancing, the chance to get a present from Santa and all the rest of it. But they've also got a reindeer lodge where essentially you can say hello to two reindeer, get some facts about them, and enjoy the warmth of their magical presence. And the Santa's Enchanted Forest announced the arrival of two reindeer on Tuesday. But by Saturday, and we're not exactly sure how this occurred because they haven't commented on this yet, by Saturday, one of the reindeers had escaped from Santa's Forest, and that sparked an eight-hour hunt for this reindeer.
So the reindeer's called Buddy. Buddy headed out of the grotto, and immediately he was seen by people, wasn't he? But many people thought he was just a deer, which must be a common slight on the reindeer, actually, Charlie.
Perhaps the sort of downgrading the sort of, you know, the exceptionalness of this case. And in fact, that's exactly what a local rescue charity called the Southport Offshore Rescue Trust thought when they were first called about this. They thought it was just a roe deer, which is a much more common type of deer. But then, you know, they've got these extraordinary pictures of Buddy walking along the beach in sort of very wet sand, which must have been absolutely freezing. And they've published this extraordinary map where they've sort of tracked the movements of the reindeer going down literally miles of Formby Beach in the dark. And you can imagine how difficult it would have been to try to actually figure out how to bring this reindeer into a sort of safe end of this, and they were very worried that the reindeer might go into the water, which could have been very dangerous.
Yes, of course, and so that would be why the Royal Marines were brought in.
Absolutely, the Royal Marines, there was a drone, there was police, there was the Coast Guard. They were all called out to help to try and to find this reindeer. They were using thermal binoculars. But of course, it was very, very difficult. But eventually, they did manage to shepherd the reindeer into these sand dunes. And of course, you know, the reindeer by this point must have been very, very tired indeed, because it lay down and had a sleep. And that meant that a vet was able to come up from Salisbury with sedatives. And it was assisted by the Royal Marines, who happened to just be on exercise at a rifle range nearby. So that was quite fortunate. But they were able to give the sedative to the reindeer. The armed police had been on standby with tranquilizer guns. So that could have been perhaps even more dramatic. But it seems that this whole thing did manage to finally come to a happy conclusion.
Charlie, I was so sad actually when I read about Buddy falling asleep in the dunes. I mean, you know, we're talking about it in a light-hearted way, and thank goodness that has had a decent ending, but this poor animal must have been scared witless, all alone on the beach in the dead at night in freezing conditions. I mean, it's quite sad, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, there's perhaps a wider question here about the use of actual reindeers in these kinds of grottos, because of course they're very large animals. If they get loose, you know, they're not going to be used to the environment that they're in. They're perhaps also going to pose a risk to pedestrians. There's a risk to themselves, of vehicles. You could quite well imagine this whole thing having had a very different ending. But of course, you know, it has just very fortunately resolved in the way that it has. I would be very surprised indeed if this did lead to any kind of change, because of course these animals are so popular at these kinds of grottos, and you do see reindeers at small parks and other things like that. But I suppose there just has to be all care taken about the way in which they're sort of stored, if that's the right word.
Yes. Well, it has had a decent ending, and we wish Buddy. And do we know the name of his accomplice, the one who stayed put, who didn't run away? Do we know what that reindeer's called?
I don't know the other reindeer's name. They've shared a video of the two reindeers arriving, and the one thing we do know is that the moss happens to be their favourite treat. So they're both big fans of moss, but Buddy is perhaps, I think, the more famous one. The other reindeer is going to have to pull off quite a feat to become as famous as Buddy.
Well, I'm with Buddy. I'd probably want out of the enchanted forest, and even if I found myself on a beach at the dead of night, maybe I'd think it was better than being petted by endless school children. In the name of education of these animals, I know that lots of you have got similar thoughts on this too. Let's talk to somebody who was part of the rescue operation, though. Nick Porter, Trustee Director and Lifeboat Coxswain of Southport Offshore Rescue. Have I pronounced coxswain correctly? It's not really a word I think I've ever said out loud before, Nick.
Coxswain.
I'm sorry. Yep. As soon as it came up, I thought, nope, I got that one wrong. Nick, so, I mean, you can't have had very many phone calls along the lines of there's a reindeer on the loose in your patch. What happened?
Yeah, I think this is the first reindeer we've been to. We quite often get horse riders who've fallen off. But yeah, first reindeer. We were called out at about 4:45 in the evening. I believe the police had been tracking the animal for some time before that. Our initial reports were that it was stuck in the mud. We've got quite a lot of soft sand, muddy areas, even quicksand on our stretch of coastline. So we initially went out to look for the animal, thinking it may be stuck. As it happened, it was going dark and the police had lost sight of him. So using our quad bikes, we got down to the area. We've got thermal binoculars on the bike, so we had a look around and they relatively quickly located him. They did attempt to capture him. They got quite close, within a couple of metres, but unfortunately every time we got close and the lads got off the bikes to catch him, he bolted off. So with it being a danger of him ending up in the either the Mersey or in the Irish Sea, we felt the best thing for us to do was to try and shepherd him back up the beach, and eventually went into the sand dunes and into Alka Rifle Range, which is how we ended up being involved with the Royal Marines as well.
Sure. So just explain the rifle range. I mean, this is just a... Can anyone wander into the rifle range?
No, it is. It is a barracks and there's regularly, Army, Royal Marine units go down there training. So it's a pretty secure environment. But obviously there's a lot of live ammunition fired around there. So, you know, even for us, if we get a rescue in that part of the beach, we have to be really careful and make sure we're checking in with the guards there that they're not firing before we proceed.
Sure.
Even around the perimeter of the site.
So, Nick, I mean, do you share our concerns about Buddy? I mean, he just must have been terrified.
Yeah, well, it's not for me to judge or, comment too much on that. But we're here as a charity providing a rescue service to the people in the area.
Yeah, and you absolutely did what the rescue service needed to do. But you can't be called out to many animals in distress, or perhaps you are.
Yeah, as I said before, we do tend to get a few horse riders who've fallen off. And obviously when they fall off, the horse bolts. So whilst our primary concern will be with the person who's fallen off, we've also got to try and help where we can with the horse. We've helped with porpoise in the past, dogs. And I think more our line of things is, if somebody loses a pet or an animal on the beach, then lots of people tend to go looking, and that's where it can become a concern for us if you get lots of people descending on the area who don't necessarily know the landscape that well.
Sure, and you've mentioned the quicksand, which would be absolutely terrifying, and also just the water temperature at this time of year. How cold would the water be?
Yeah, it's pretty cold this time of year. I don't know exactly, but I know... this time of year, it's not uncommon for it to be, in single figures, even colder. So it's not somewhere I'd like to be.
No, for sure. Thank you so much for talking to us this afternoon. That is Nick Porter, who is part of Southport Offshore Rescue. And, Roy, I mean, thank goodness they were there, because this poor creature, and we'll just leave all the lighthearted stuff aside now, I think. We'll leave it aside.
We will, but Ryan will not.
Will indulge us. So, you know, if he thought my only option is to try and swim across this incredibly chilly piece of water to get somewhere where I might be feeling a bit safer, that is a terrible position, actually.
It is.
For him to be in.
It feels a little bit like, listening to Nick speak there, it feels a little bit like the alternative Christmas animated 5-minute slot to The Snowman. The story of Buddy, and turned out quite well. I don't know. I also feel quite strongly that I just don't think reindeer should be involved in children's, like, real life reindeer. Just have a toy. It just feels wrong. I'm not surprised he broke free and tried to escape.
No, I know. I think I agree with you entirely. And in fact, if we go into our canteen here at Times Towers, they've already got the animated nodding reindeer that we have every year. It was one of the main reasons that Jane and I joined the organisation, because we were so impressed with our Christmas decorations. They are lifelike, they are charming, they are wonderful, and they won't bolt for it, because they've just got batteries in them. I mean, it's just a fact. They're just toys. And it might be an awful lot easier than poor old Buddy. We wish him well, and we're glad that he's safe back in, you know, the home that he's been placed in. But, yeah, how enchanting do you really need your forest to be?
You don't really.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
It is 3 o'clock. You're listening to Fee Glover and Ryan Nika on Times Radio. In the next hour, we'll talk about why the Chancellor's budget was leaked 45 minutes early, what it meant for the country's finances. Israeli football fans were banned from coming to a football match in the UK last month. We will talk about that one too. Cryptocurrency crime is on the rise. That's in our Money Matters item with Adam Shaw. And if you're looking for some brilliant books to buy for Christmas, tune in for our literary salon with Tinsel at 3:30. First, it's the news with James Kitchen.
Thank you, Fee. Good afternoon. The spending watchdog says last week's leak of the Chancellor's budget details was the worst failure in its 15-year history. In a report, the Office for Budget Responsibility concluded its forecast release was not intentionally leaked, nor a case of a button being pressed too early. It also found the leak was not the result of hostile cyber activity, but rather down to IT configuration issues. The OBR says a new publishing system must be in place by spring. It comes as Keir Starmer's insisted the Chancellor did not lie to the public when she said there was a black hole in the country's finances in the build-up to the budget. The OBR says it told Rachel Reeves in advance the economic outlook was better than expected. The Conservative leader, Kemi Badenoch, says the Chancellor should resign and accuses her of giving false information. But in a speech in London, the Prime Minister backed his colleague, insisting it was a budget to be proud of. The political economist Will Hutton told Times Radio the OBR has too much responsibility.
It's been made to be judge, jury and prosecutor of the budget process, and that's too much power. In my view, that some part of that should be brought in-house. Yes, Britain needs an independent institution to kind of mark the government's books and to keep it honest, but it doesn't need to make it so central to the budget-making process that it takes away what politicians are deciding. Ultimately, these are kind of political decisions and political judgments.
Meanwhile, the US has announced a deal with Britain for zero tariffs on pharmaceutical products and medical technology. The deal includes an increase in the percentage NHS budget that's spent on medicines. Labour's Tulip Siddiq says she has her party's full backing after being sentenced to 2 years in prison in Bangladesh.
This whole thing has been so unfair, and they've seen leading legal experts point out the flaws in this process. So I certainly will not be considering my position. All the Bangladeshi authorities had to do is contact me, because I would have shown them that I have nothing to hide.
She claims a corruption trial's been driven by a political vendetta. The MP's been accused of illegally gaining land from her aunt, who used to be the country's prime minister. The Afghanistan inquiry has heard there was a deliberate policy among a UK special forces unit to kill fighting-age males who posed no threat. In a note from 2011, a senior officer warned the director of UKSF about the policy, sharing concerns from the unit's commanding officer. The officer, who can't be named, said a conscious decision was made to cover up potential war crimes. The Liberal Democrat MP Mike Martin is a member of the Defence Select Committee and served multiple tours in Afghanistan. Speaking to Times Radio, he said the actions of special forces may have put regular soldiers in danger.
When I speak to my colleagues, there's a huge amount of anger directed at the special forces because we, you know, took the time to be very careful about who we were targeting and all the rest of it, because that was the right thing to do and that was legal. We want to use force legally, and there's a huge amount of anger directed at special forces because these guys are meant to be the elite and they just went around and committed war crimes willy-nilly, which then put us in danger on the ground.
And an investigation into the Post Office Horizon scandal is considering corporate manslaughter charges. The National Police Chiefs Council has expanded its list of criminal suspects to 8. Operation Olympus is looking into the wrongful prosecution of hundreds of sub-postmasters. Officers are also warning of delays without further funding. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on the Times radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB, online, and on your smart speaker. Afternoons on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms.
Many of you are pointing out that reindeers come from very cold climates, therefore they'll be absolutely fine on the beach and in the sand dunes. Just a selection. Mike says, I think reindeer come from colder climes. Sheila says, can we just bear in mind that Buddy is a reindeer who lives in areas close to the Arctic Circle? Probably means the sea temperatures aren't that chilly. And Keith Hogg says, I know it's Christmas and we get a bit soppy, but the escaped reindeer would have been quite fine in the sand dunes in the peace and quiet. Remember, it's meant to be in the Arctic tundra. It was probably quite comfortable chewing the cud in the peace and quiet. Genuine question. I'm not trying to back up my own soppy argument here. But if you've had a reindeer raised in this country in a different climate, would it be as acclimatised as it would be if it had grown up in the tundra near the Arctic Circle in freezing temperatures? I'm looking at you, Roya. You may not be a reindeer expert. I don't know.
Can exclusively reveal I do not know the answer to that question. But I would imagine if I had been raised and reared as reindeer are in the UK instead of in the Arctic tundra, I probably would feel the chill a little bit more than I normally would if I was used to Arctic conditions, would be my hunch.
OK, if anybody out there can top that knowledge, we'd love to hear from you. And Neil says, is the reindeer runaway now lying exhausted on a beach a metaphor for the Labour budget? Let's talk about the budget. The leak of the budget, 45 minutes, very clever, Neil, before it was delivered, has been called the worst failure in the Office for Budget Responsibility's history. In a new report, the independent fiscal watchdog said its assessment of the budget hadn't been properly hidden from public view due to errors and systemic issues. It comes as polls suggest that even before the budget, two-thirds of the public thought the Prime Minister wasn't being honest about the challenges facing the country. A survey by Opinium reports half of the public dislikes the budget, with the same number thinking it will make them worse off. Let's talk about all of this with Simon French, Managing Director and Chief Economist of Panmure Liberum, who joins us now. Simon French, very good afternoon from us. Just tell us your thoughts on how damaging the leak has been.
Well, it's a damaging leak for the reputation of the OBI. It rightly describes it as the most embarrassing set of events in its 15-year history. Whether it changes the view of their core function, which is to be able to forecast the economic and fiscal outlook for the UK, I very much doubt. But it does when you, and I've just sort of been looking through the document that's just been put at the right time, it's hasten to add, on their website, you actually see that they're blaming somewhat amateur IT behavior in terms of putting a URL on there that people can guess. That speaks to not a huge lot of IT sophistication. Whether it should therefore pollute their institutional role, their forecasting role, I have my doubts.
Yeah. Just tell us where you think the OBR will be at the time of the next
budget. You know, there'll be a fair amount of jokes every time it does publish something. And, you know, you're right to make one yourself about what it's just posted up on its website. You know, so that can be a little bit of a kind of drip undermining it. But the substance of what this office does, is it really changed by somebody being a bit hapless with a URL?
No, it isn't. I think what it perhaps does in terms of looking at substantive changes is there is always a degree of negotiation back and forth between the OBR and the Treasury and Chancellors. And this is a completely politically agnostic comment that took place under the Conservatives, under the Coalition, and now under Labour. And always, you know, who has got the stronger negotiating hand when discussing things like, you know, how much does a certain policy impact economic growth, trigger employment, for example? I would say going into the next forecasting round, the Treasury are going to feel a little bit sort of superior, let's say, as a result of these events. Is that going to materially affect that back and forth on the impact of policy? Maybe at the very margin, but as I say, I don't think this is a big fundamental change. I think more interesting from a personality standpoint is whether Richard Hughes, the head of the OBR, will survive this week or whether he will have to fall on his sword and take responsibility for this.
Do you think he will?
Oh, what a question. I think it'd be unfair if he did. I mean, he isn't directly responsible for the IT, and this seems to be an IT problem. The reason I sort of suck on my gums is that he would be a useful human shield given the reception of the budget just generally in terms of the whole conduct of the process and indeed the content of the budget unveiled by the Chancellor last week.
Do you know the man personally? I mean, if he does have to fall on his sword, or if it is suggested it would be good for him to fall on his sword, is the OBR substantially weakened by his brain not being there?
I don't know Richard well. I think the people I do know well who've worked a lot with Richard rate him very, very highly. I think there's no doubt that he is one of the preeminent fiscal economists in the UK, and that would be a loss. There are other people who can do that job, so we shouldn't overstate it. But I think this is a politics rather than a capability question, whether he survives the week.
Sure. Let's talk more about the politics then, please, Simon. The Prime Minister has been out today promoting his long-term growth strategy. What have you made of that?
There was some stuff in there that I really liked. So the Nuclear Regulatory Task Force released both a scathing report on the fact that deployment of new nuclear capability in the UK is comfortably the most expensive in the world. The task force proposed a series of deregulatory measures to try and reverse that journey, and the Prime Minister appears to have adopted those in full, and that shows a sign that he gets to understand what I wrote in the paper this morning, which is the UK has developed an inflationary problem, particularly led by its energy market. My frustration is that this seems a bit piecemeal in terms of understanding the need for disinflationary deregulation. Where is this in housing? Where is this in construction more broadly than just nuclear? Where is this in financial services? Where is this in manufacturing? There are a whole raft of areas in the economy where, if you excuse the phraseology, we've had somewhat luxury beliefs of the last 15 years since the global financial crisis on what is affordable, because effectively interest rates were zero and the central bank, the Bank of England, was buying our debt. We have to engage with reality on how much of this we can afford and still generate economic growth.
Right. I'm interested by that phrase, luxury thinking. Can you flesh that out a little bit more for us? I mean, for instance, is Ed Miliband's whole take on renewable energy, is that luxury thinking?
Yes.
Okay. Could you flesh that out a bit more?
Of course I can. So the idea that we know, as however sophisticated the Department for Energy Security and Net Zero is, which is going to be the most cost competitive source of energy to lower bills for all Times Radio listeners in 10, 15, 20, 30 years' time is a nonsense. We don't know. But what we do know, and this is where economics is a pretty powerful social science, is that the price mechanism, the allocation of capital, will root out which is the most cost efficient, which is the most productively efficient way of providing electricity. And the fact that we keep limiting certain types of supply, and in this case, North Sea oil and gas development, is a nonsense.
Right. And similarly, and by the way, thank you for fleshing that out. I equally loved your one-word answer. It is so rare to hear that. It took me completely by surprise. My brain as an interviewer, Simon, is conditioned to think that any answer will give me at least 45 seconds to understand it and move on to the next topic. So thank you for that. Just talk me through housing, though, and whether or not you think exactly the same thing is happening there, because so many people within the housing industry and all of the other industries coupled around housing say that it is a lack of a long-term vision and an honesty about that long-term supply chain that means that they cannot make the decisions that they want to make now. Would you agree with that too?
Yeah, I won't give you a one-word answer to that. It's a big question that requires a lot of unpacking. You'll probably get your 45 seconds here. So what you have in the UK is we are aspiring now to build 1.5 million houses over a five-year period. That's 300,000 houses a year. We haven't done that in modern history, and therefore the supply chain of plumbers, electricians, bricklayers, all the trades is simply not there. And that doesn't respond quickly. These people need training up. There needs to be, as the industry is rightly saying, a clear, long-dated commitment on the types of houses, where they're going to be built, and ensure, and I think this is the crucial point from an economic standpoint, that it is cost efficient to produce these houses. I mean, the government is now spending over the next 5 years £39 billion of our money, taxpayers' money, on affordable housing. A very noble aim, but they have to do this. They have to subsidise the sector because they have made it so costly for private sector developers to build affordable houses. So we are sort of squeezing the balloon or batting the rat or whatever your sort of preferred metaphor is. If we strip back some of those restrictions, we have a very, very profitable, successful private sector building industry that can go out and build those homes. The problem is the government gets in the way.
Mm. Do you believe at the moment that we can be realistic and optimistic, and that the message from the government could have been both realistic and optimistic? Or are those two things mutually exclusive at the moment because of wider economic forces?
There's definitely a requirement for realism about the impact that an aging population is going to have, not just this year, not just next year, but for years and years and years to come, particularly if we want to have an NHS free at the point of use, particularly if we want to have a triple lock pension. So realism around the debate is essential. My frustration with this government is that there have been some own goals in terms of, particularly after the general election last year, being particularly trying to pin the political blame on its predecessor, which really smashed consumer and business confidence unnecessarily. I also think in the run-up to this budget, one of the big lessons learned is just say less. I wrote in the Times 2 weeks ago, say less. And indeed, as I've just alluded to in the form of the construction and house building industry, also do less. A culture of Westminster of speaking less and doing less will be hugely welcomed by the private sector, yeah, and you generate more growth.
In speaking more, do you think that Rachel Reeves and Keir Starmer believe that actually they are being more honest with the electorate? You know, if we were going to be kind about the motivation for certainly the pre-budget speech that Rachel Reeves gave, do you think that we could attribute it to that?
I personally have a lot of time for the Chancellor, to a slightly lesser extent, the Prime Minister, who I have had less contact with. But the Chancellor I have a lot of time with. I feel her backbenchers have made her job close to impossible. And I think part of the reason that the budget was so difficult was the backbenchers of a party that has a 150-seat majority in Parliament could not sanction relatively modest changes to winter fuel payments, to the personal independence payment, and to the two-child benefit cap. And that created about a £10 billion black hole, which the Chancellor has tried to close, but she hasn't got the political air cover from her next-door neighbour at number 10.
And very much, Simon, like the fly bashing itself against the window on a hot day all the time, is she eventually, or maybe quite soon, just going to have to be released by opening the window a bit?
Maybe, but I think the financial markets at the moment look at the current Chancellor as better than almost all other alternatives on the Labour benches. So perhaps Pat McFadden, the DWP minister, or Yvette Cooper could be, if you like, status quo incumbents at number 11. But I think any other Labour MP and the cost the UK will pay for its debt would go up. Inflation expectations would go up, and the appetite to make difficult decisions on the public finances would be seen as being diluted.
Very good to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed. That's Simon French, who's Managing Director and Chief Economist of Panmure Liberum.
The Chief Constable of West Midlands Police, Craig Guildford, is giving evidence to MPs over the banning of Maccabi Tel Aviv fans from Villa Park last month.
The decision to restrict the away fans was based on a very careful assessment. It wasn't taken lightly, and it was taken on the basis of an assessment of the risk. And when we assess the risk, we look at information and we look at intelligence. And in particular, we were swayed by the commanders of the Dutch police and their direct reference to what happened from their perspective. Not my perspective, not Lord Mann's perspective, but their perspective to our Chief Inspector who was on that meeting.
And we'll have more on that in just a moment.
The State of It is the new podcast from The Times and The Sunday Times. Join political heavyweights Stephen Swinford, Caroline Wheeler, Gabriel Pogrund and Patrick Maguire.
Only a very small handful of the people that I go out for lunch with will actually want to have a glass of wine. Nigel Farage is definitely one of them.
No party loyalty, just the inside track on the decisions and policymakers that shape your life. The State of It is available to listen now on the Times Radio app or from your preferred podcast provider.
I am so looking forward to Christmas. I absolutely love everything about it. Decorating the tree, wrapping the presents. For us, it's always been a big family get-together. Me, Mike, the kids, my sister Julie, and all her family too. We all go back home to Mum and Dad's house. It's a bit of a squeeze these days, but Mum and Dad are both in their 80s now, and it's really important that we all go where we've always gone for Christmas. It just wouldn't be the same any other way. Thankfully, this year we have Carol, Mum and Dad's lovely care professional from Home Instead. Home Instead are amazing. I honestly don't know what we'd do without them. Carol comes and visits in the week when we're all busy at work and makes sure that Mum and Dad have everything they need. Obviously, this year we've all offered to help with preparing the Christmas dinner, but Mum absolutely insists that she's got it all under control. Which means Carol has.
For award-winning home care you can trust, go to homeinstead.co.uk.
Visit Times Radio on YouTube for the latest videos and interviews.
Afternoons on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens, helping create kitchens to feel proud of. From expert design consultants who'll measure your space and bring your vision to life on a 3D plan, through to a professional installation service. Learn more at wix.co.uk.
Now, back to the Maccabi Tel Aviv controversy. Well, supporters of the Israel team were stopped from attending the European tie after police cited intelligence from disorder at a previous match in the Netherlands. That intelligence has now been described as untrue by Dutch police speaking to the Sunday Times. Well, Daniel Sugarman is the deputy editor of Jewish News UK. Daniel, can you just talk me through the events that led to the fans being banned in the first place last month?
Certainly, and thank you for having me. I feel that there was a certain amount of trepidation when the fixture was first announced, which I believe was sometime in September. And at that point in time, there were various questions as to who was going to be ultimately responsible in terms of ensuring the policing for the match. There were suspicions at that point that the situation in Birmingham could spiral out of control if things were not properly attended to. And then what happened, as far as we know, is a week or so before the fixture, a couple of weeks, the BSAG, the Safety Advisory Group for Birmingham, announced that no Maccabi Tel Aviv fans would be permitted to attend the match. And a police report was cited as one of the reasons why the Safety Advisory Group had made that decision. Now, in the run-up to that decision being made, there was a significant amount of noise being made by some local MPs, as well as certain people within Birmingham itself, who seemed to suggest that there would be a real uproar were Maccabi Tel Aviv fans to come. And one of the things that happened as part of that was that the match that had taken place the previous November in 2024, Maccabi Tel Aviv against Ajax Amsterdam, was cited as a reason why the Maccabi Tel Aviv fans should not come, and specifically blaming the Maccabi Tel Aviv fans for the unfortunate scenes of violence that were seen in Amsterdam in November 2024. But as has been subsequently talked about at some length, not least by John Mann today, actually, in the Home Affairs Select Committee, a lot of what has been said about what took place in November 2024, including in that police report, which was subsequently handed to the Birmingham Safety Advisory Group, was inaccurate.
Now, the Dutch police have told my colleague Gabriel Progrand on the Sunday Times that that evidence that was presented was untrue. What have you made of the evidence that you have seen and how that's been interpreted?
So a couple of days ago, Nick Timothy MP released both the report from West Midlands Police as well as the report from a Dutch police, both in the original Dutch and a translated version. It's clear if you compare those reports and look at them side by side, but a lot of things just simply don't match up. So a lot of the claims that are made in the West Midlands Police report are not mentioned anywhere within the Amsterdam Police report. And it's also clear to see various inaccuracies beyond that in the West Midlands Police report. So, for instance, the claim that Maccabi Tel Aviv's previous European fixture against the British team was against West Ham on a specific date, when a simple Google would show that West Ham did play that night. They played Olympiakos, a Greek team. They didn't play Maccabi Tel Aviv at all. So it's things like that that permeate. But then also, the cutting to the heart of the matter, some of the claims that are made in the West Midlands Police report are simply not true. So the idea, for instance, that 500 Maccabi fans specifically targeted the Muslim community in Amsterdam is completely untrue. Again, the claim that Maccabi Tel Aviv fans threw people in what's described as the river is completely untrue. The only video footage that we have seen, that anyone I believe has seen, of anything like that in November 2024 is actually Maccabi Tel Aviv fans being thrown in the canal by people who clearly don't happen to like Israelis very much. So the report, those are not the only examples. So it rapidly becomes clear that somewhere along the line, if we're looking at it in the most charitable light, somewhere along the line, communication has completely broken down. I know you played a clip before talking, I think it was the chief constable of West Midlands Police talking about how one of his chief inspectors talked to Amsterdam chief inspectors. Well, as was also made clear, the Amsterdam chief inspector seemed to have absolutely no idea about some of the claims that the West Midlands police have put forward. So at the most charitable, there has been a massive breakdown in communication. If we're being slightly less charitable, we can make other accusations.
I must ask, Daniel, what would those other accusations be? Because, I mean, the inference from a lot of people within the community has been, there is a suggestion here that some people or some you know, some communities are trying to turn Birmingham into a, in, you know, to deter Jewish people from coming to Birmingham. What would you say to that?
I think that there is a strong suspicion within the Jewish community in the UK that there are elements within Birmingham who do not want anyone who is perceived as being broadly Zionist, by which we mean supporting the right of Israel to exist as a country, should be allowed, shall we say, in Birmingham. I think that prior to the match, there were those within Birmingham who were effectively rabble-rousing and were talking about large numbers of people from within Birmingham coming out onto the streets in opposition to Maccabi Tel Aviv fans appearing because they were Israeli. And for no particular other reason. Now, of course, the emotions have been running high in the UK for a couple of years, and people will, of course, cite the Israel-Gaza war as having inflamed tensions here in the UK. But the fact remains that I strongly believe that even had the Israel-Gaza war not been a factor, there would have been many of those same people in Birmingham who would have been extremely opposed to any Israeli fans coming because they believe that Israel and anything associated with Israel should be boycotted. And of course, there, within much of the Jewish community, both in this country and elsewhere, there are extremely close ties between the Jewish communities of the diaspora and the state of Israel, Israel being the only Jewish state. Most people here will have very strong family connections to Israel, very strong religious connections, historic, emotional. And so it's very, very hard. There will, of course, be people within Birmingham who say, "Oh, we're only against Zionists. We're not against Jews." But if you scratch the surface, you find that often the words Zionist and Jew seem to be synonymous for some of those same people.
That's Daniel Sugarman, Deputy Editor of Jewish News UK. Thank you.
It is almost 3:30. Thank you for your messages this afternoon. We'll do Tracy's setting of the piano on fire in the next half an hour of the programme. Monica says, and this was about the interview with Simon French. Incidentally, you can read Simon's columns in the Times if you've got a digital subscription. They are both entertaining and educational. Monica says, at last, sensible, balanced conversation instead of the constant bullying we've heard from the media since the budget. Jim texted in to say, another fantastic Times Radio interview, enlightening, informative and entertaining. No flannel, just clear thinking. Thank you, Simon and Jane. And then a couple of minutes later, Jim texted in again to say, regarding my last message, thank you, Roya and Simon. Apologies, I missed the start. I mean, Jim, what does a girl have to do? It's Fee here with Roya Nika on Times Radio. Jane's away for a couple of days. Oh, I know, we all sound the same.
Jim's very sad about that.
Yes, Jim, it was me and Simon. I thought he was incredibly entertaining as well. And you got to love someone who just gives you a one-word answer. Coming up, what book should be on your Christmas list? It's Fee and Roya on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms. Let's get a check on the very latest news headlines with James Kitchen.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you, Fee. Good afternoon. Forecasters' early leak of the budget has been described as the worst failure in the spending watchdog's history. The Office for Budget Responsibility published analysis around 40 minutes before the Chancellor stood up in the Commons. And investigations confirmed there was no hostile cyber activity. Meanwhile, the Prime Minister's insisted Rachel Reeves did not lie to the public when she said there was a black hole in the country's finances before her budget.
There was no misleading, and I simply don't accept, and I was receiving the numbers, that being told that the OBR productivity review means you've got £16 billion less than you would otherwise have had shows that you've got an easy starting point.
The OBR says it told the Treasury the economic outlook was better than expected. Sir Keir Starmer says he's proud of the budget, which he claims will lift hundreds of thousands of children out of poverty. 0% tariffs have been agreed on UK medicines into the United States. Ministers also say fewer treatments could be blocked on cost-effectiveness grounds. The West Midlands police chief says he was swayed by Dutch officers when deciding to ban Maccabi Tel Aviv fans from an Aston Villa match. Israel called it anti-Semitic, while Sir Keir Starmer says he was angered by the decision. and 8 suspects have been identified in a possible criminal investigation into the faulty Horizon software used by sub-postmasters. Corporate manslaughter charges are now being considered. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio.
Christmas was a tough time in my family. I became homeless as an adult. I had to turn to a food bank.
This Christmas, your gift to Trussell could help provide emergency food and expert advice. For people like Aaron, it'll be a lifeline.
This Christmas, my dream is that people leave the food bank with hope.
If you can, please give to Trussell today. You can help food banks provide an emergency food parcel and support someone facing hunger this winter. Search Trussell today.
I'm Adam Vaughan, Environment Editor at The Times. And in Planet Hope, we meet the people tackling our biggest environmental and scientific challenges. From saving penguins in Patagonia to helping people with paralysis to move again. These are stories of science, courage, and hope. Follow Planet Hope wherever you get your podcasts. Planet Hope is brought to you by The Times in paid partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative.
Wake up to a brighter breakfast. Times Radio Breakfast, 7 days a week from 6 a.m.
Afternoons on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens. Choose from over 80 kitchen styles, whether it's your first home or your forever home. Find your dream kitchen at Wix. Prices start from under £3,000. Book your free kitchen design appointment today at wix.co.uk.
Tracy says, thank you for asking about this. I was once given a summer job playing the piano in a local vegetarian restaurant. The recently restored Victorian piano had built-in candle holders either side of the piano's music stand. On my first night there, the owners lit the candles and I started playing. One piece by Hoagy Carmichael didn't stick in my memory, so I used the sheet music. Unfortunately, as I turned the page, the music caught fire, which set fire to the whole piano. I got paid to not come back and later became a vegetarian. That was part two of our Tracy's Done Weird Things on Piano section. More to follow. And Kaya has promised to send us a Christmas jumper picture, and he certainly has.
Does not disappoint.
It doesn't disappoint at all. Do you want to describe it there, Roya?
Yes, I can describe it. It's very Christmassy.
It is. It's Santa. As he said, it's Santa going up in a rocket. And you've got Santa's beard and a pom-pom on Santa's hat in kind of relief. I'd say that the jumper may have a polyester base to it. It's hanging.
It looks flammable.
It doesn't, yeah. It's not really hanging like a wool jumper would.
Do you think God would approve of it? Do you think the Dean would approve of it?
I think the Dean of Salisbury would heartily approve of it. And the legend at the bottom is Slays as So Last Christmas. Kaya, thank you very much indeed for that. That has made our afternoon. We're 0333 003 2353.
I'm going to make Kaya wear that into the office when he's next in. But now, time to enter our literary salon, grab a cup of something mulled and have a seat, because Alex Clark, host of the TLS podcast, is joining us to share her top recommendations for 2025, in case you're looking for that perfect book to gift this Christmas. First up is A Schooling in Murder by Andrew Taylor, and it's set in a girls' boarding school in 1945. Alex, tell us a little bit more about it. What sets this apart from all other...
I listen to and read a lot of crime and thrillers. I particularly like listening when I've got a really long journey. And actually, I did listen to this. It's really well narrated on audiobook, but would be a brilliant read too. He's a great writer, Andrew Taylor. All the sentences are lovely, but it's so fun. Imagine it's a really kind of run down girls' boarding school, and it is administered by a couple of real tartars, you know, some real kind of, they wouldn't take any nonsense, but it's mired in scandal because one of the teachers has been found at the bottom of a cliff, and it is her who tells us the story. Now, I am quite often mildly allergic to stories narrated by ghosts, but I made an exception and I'm glad I did.
I mean, it doesn't scream Christmas, stories told by ghosts. Does it,
A Christmas Carol.
True.
What?
True.
I know what you're saying. We've gone past Halloween and we should be getting into a rather less scary and more sort of enticing kind of vibe.
Do you think, Alex, everyone can appreciate it who hasn't been to a girls' boarding school?
Well, I haven't. But mind you, I think that that's what get. I mean, at school, it wasn't, you know, once I had left behind the kind of Enid Blyton obsessions, I went straight into Storky and Co., which is about a boys' boarding school. And I imagined I had a whole fantasy life. This is not what you asked. I had a whole fantasy life about the thought that I could be the first girl to go to Storky and Co.'s boarding school, i.e. a Victorian boarding school. So I think the people who didn't go to boarding school and don't therefore realise how horrible it is actually really like it. So no, it's a thoroughly good murder mystery.
So anyone in the family would enjoy this as a gift?
Yes, I think so. And look, I wanted to include things that you could absolutely give as presents, but also say, I'm sorry, I've got a slight headache, which is code for I'm going to my room to read a book. Don't bother me. So they're also presents for you, the giver of Christmas.
Okay. So next up, Alex, is what we can know, which is Ian McEwan's latest tome. And I interviewed Ian, actually, on this programme a couple of months ago. It's quite an interesting, challenging book, I would say. I wouldn't say it's right at the top of my Ian McEwan books, but talk us through the premise of it. It's a lot of climate change and a lot of sort of pessimism about what's happened to the world, but a little glimmer of optimism. Is that a fair summation?
I suppose so, but that's kind of half of the book, isn't it? Mm. So it's part of the book is narrated by an academic at a future UK university. He's a academic of the humanities, of English literature, and he's obsessed with a long-lost poem. Mm. But I mean, nobody's interested in what's happening in the humanities departments of university at this point. I mean, you might say this isn't very much futurology. This is sort of what's happening now. But he also has to get to the Bodleian Library, you know, famously in Oxford. Well, it's now been removed to Snowdonia and he has to get to it by boat because the UK is underwater. And so that's the sort of future, the dystopia. But as people often find with these sort of near future post-apocalyptic books, you know, it's a future that could all too easily happen. It's not particularly far-fetched. But you also get drawn into the story of this horrible sounding poet and his rather long-suffering wife. And in common with many men who don't do things like take the bins out, he's very good at the sort of grand gesture. And his grand gesture is to write a poem in a very, very archaic and elaborate form of sonnets and to read it at her birthday dinner party. A dinner party, by the way, that she has done all the cooking for. So she's not particularly bothered by it. But in any case, it's gone missing.
There are lots of twists and turns in this book,
yeah,
which is I wish I had, but maybe I'll go back to it.
You know what? I think there's also a thing about sort of later Ian McEwan. He is evolving this very sort of capacious kind of storytelling style. I mean, some of his earlier works were really quite short. Mm. But I don't know, if you didn't perhaps thrill to this book, you might really enjoy Lessons, which is a whole life story. It's his book before this one.
Okay, maybe I'm too stuck in my Atonement and Enduring Love Past. I mean, it's a fair point.
You have to move with the author's career too. Maybe.
Right.
I don't know.
You're right, Alex. You're right. Of course you are.
Look, I'm not here to wag the finger. You must read what you like.
Finally, there's a book that I know Fee loves and has also recommended, The Heart-Shaped Tin by B. Wilson.
So tell us
about this.
Well, look,
both tell us about this.
I really, really, really love books that are about food that are also brilliantly written, and B. Wilson is such a great writer. And The Heart-Shaped Tin is, and she's written lots of books actually telling us how to make our life easy in the kitchen, how to make something that's nutritious, and delicious and doesn't take you all evening, and you can do it in between all the other things that you've got to do. She's very good on what food means to you emotionally. And the heart-shaped tin, the tin of the title, is the tin in which she baked her wedding cake, and her marriage is not still extant. She's not still married to the person that she baked that cake for and with. And so there's a lot about the nostalgia, the feelings of loss that all kitchen objects and cooking itself and food itself embody in some ways. We all remember something that we ate with someone who's perhaps for whatever reason no longer in our life. All those kind of things. I loved it.
What did you love about it?
Well, I loved exactly the same things that Alex is talking about. And also, she's still got the tin. I mean, it's a win.
You'd keep the tin. I mean, lose the husband, keep the tin.
Yeah, I think that's the...
Lose the husband, keep the tin. That's a great T-shirt.
I wonder if... I mean, I've said that, you know, I've not been very nice about husbands, and it's very shortly my wedding anniversary. I mean, I just don't know why I'm saying these
things.
Is it
a tin anniversary, Alex? How many years?
No, it's not. It's four. It's silk and linens, which a fact that I have... I don't really hold with all that kind of stuff, but... I've made it very clear that it is silk and linen. I wouldn't be advertising the fact that it was tin, but I'm saying it's silk and it's linen.
Hint, hint, hint.
I think the title, Lose the Husband, Keep the Tin. Yes. I mean, it's the self-help book of our time.
We need.
Isn't it?
Alex, have there been any particular literary trends of this year that you've noticed or you've been particularly drawn to?
Well, there have been some really, really nice sort of big books. And very recently, you know, the Booker Prize was awarded recently. I admire, isn't perhaps the word, David Zaloy's Flesh, which was the winner. But I was also a big fan of Kieran Desai's novel, The Loneliness of Sonia and Sonny, which is a big, big novel about big themes. It's got a sort of love story at its centre, but it's really about... migration and immigration and emigration and remigration and family and marriage and culture clash. And I really thought that was a great book. And I have noticed a fair few big books, and I kind of like a big book. Balance that with the odd short story and you've sort of onto a winning formula for the bits where you want to disappear over Christmas. But yes, I think there have been some big involving stories. And I also think there've been quite a lot of books about people's journeys through time and relationship with historical events.
Oh, I can't wait to get stuck into a few of those over Christmas. Please can the royal family go quiet and let me.
Do you think that that's likely to happen? Do you have to keep your phone on all the time just in case of a royal alert?
Affirmative.
Oh, goodness.
I know.
Well, keep some short books by the bedside table as well, because you might not get through a long book. Alex, it's always lovely to have your thoughts. Thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Pleasure.
We've started something because Christine has sent in a very lovely picture of two coffee tins. Lose the husband, keep two tins. That's the book that she's going to write too. I always thought it'd be great to write a self-help book for Jane Austen fans, just called Dear Reader, I Divorced Him.
Brilliant.
Right, we are going to talk about money in a couple of moments' time with Adam Shaw, and a startling fact about the number of people who are victims of crypto scams. You're listening to Riot and Fee on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
This Christmas, Times Radio and Thomas Fudge's Biscuits invite you to experience a Yuletide trip you'll never forget. Search Times Radio competitions and enter to win an enchanting three-night Christmas getaway for two in either Vienna, Prague or Copenhagen, courtesy of Thomas Fudge's Remarkable Biscuits. This delicious experience includes flights, luxury hotel accommodation, dinner and £500 spending money. Celebrate Christmas in style with Times Radio and Thomas Fudge's. Hats off to Remarkable Biscuits.
Download the free Times Radio app and listen to us wherever you are.
Stand out without splashing out in the Furniture Village Black Friday sale, with unmissable savings on sofas, dining, beds and bedroom furniture, delivered in time for Christmas. The Furniture Village Black Friday sale ends Monday.
I believe those who are curious see the world differently. At Viking, we have always been curious and quite a bit different. For over 25 years, we've been connecting the thinking person with the world. First on the great rivers, then on all five oceans, now on all seven continents. We are One Viking, exploring the world in comfort.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Adam Shaw, have I turned myself off? Oh, no, I've got a loose headphone jack.
Oh, you've
I've gone into trade speak here. I'm so sorry about this, everybody.
Are you back on?
But I am back on, but I wouldn't know if I was off because it just keeps on flickering in and out. Ryan's going to sort it out for me, are you? Yes, I'm okay now. I'm on air.
Phew, what a relief.
That's always the thing that you're worried about, isn't it? Financial fraud is the most frequent crime in the UK. Cryptocurrency fraud is the fastest growing area of financial crime. Investment scams in general are now robbing people of £500,000 a day. Adam Shaw is here to tell us a little bit more. I found these figures astonishing just because I didn't realise that quite so many people are involved in cryptocurrency.
Well, I think the cryptocurrency issue itself is different in that it's not so that much everyone's involved in it, but there are very big sums being lost here, and especially, I think, in cryptocurrency. But it is astounding on two fronts. One is that the biggest crimes in the UK are financial crimes, and that crypto crimes are rising by, I think, 15%, 16% over the past 12 months or so. So this is a big, big deal, and people losing a lot of money.
How are people being scammed? What's the method?
Well, in lots of ways. It's old scams dressed up in something new. These are romance scams where people pretend to sort of befriend you and you have build a relationship. They're fake investment platforms, so you think you're investing in something that doesn't actually exist. And they've got quite sophisticated, so that some of these criminals are inventing websites where you give them the money and then you watch your investment rise, and it generates graphs and things. And there's one uncovered recently which took tens of millions of pounds. And the website was not true. It was just a fake graph. And so you want to put more money into it as well. And so also, I think the worst type of scam here is called recovery scams, where you've been scammed, then another criminal contacts you, and perhaps part of the same gang, and says, I know you've been scammed. I can get your money back. Pay me this fee. And it's just another scam. So you lose money on top of money. So that's the way it works.
One of the things that has always put me off investing in cryptocurrency is my feeling that I am not as protected in the crypto world as I would be in the real pounds, shillings and pence world. So that you store £85,000 in a bank or investment scheme or whatever, and it's covered.
Yes.
In case that turns out to be a bad thing or the bank collapses or whatever. I've always assumed that that is just not there for cryptocurrency at all. Therefore, I'm equally bewildered as to why so many people would put their money in.
Okay, so there's two answers to that. One is, you're right, it doesn't have the same protection as a lot of sort of Financial Conduct Authority and FSA covered bank accounts are. If they go bust, you're covered for the vast majority of the money, unless you've got some huge sum in there. And that's the appeal of it. As a currency, as a trading investment, if you like, for a lot of people, it's untraceable. It's backed by blockchain technology, and that's why a lot of criminals use it. You just go, once it's gone, it's gone. So that's the appeal. The other thing, that's the appeal for criminals. The other answer to your question is, why would people want to invest in it? Well, the reason people want to invest in it is that, despite the fact I don't invest in it because it's scarily volatile, it's madly volatile, this is really like a roller coaster ride. But having said all of that, I was trying to find out when it went, how much it rose this year. From memory, I think it might be up 400%. Just looking for my notes, I think it's up about 400% this year. So look, there's money to be made. That's why people go into this thing. And terribly, actually, when you look at who's falling victim to these criminals and these crimes, it is people who desperately need a lot of money quite quickly. You might be in trouble and go, ah, here's a way out. And they've been, you know, targeted because, actually, they're tech savvy. The typical victim of this crime is not the typical victim of other financial crimes. They tend to be younger, late 20s, early 30s, they tend to be tech savvy, and they tend to be wanting or needing some quick money. And that's actually the profile that people are attacking. And they're following, you know, social influencers, famous personalities and the criminals have put out fake adverts from these people. They are not really supporting these investments, but they come with some credibility and therefore terribly for the personality. Their name is getting associated with these crimes, and terribly for the victims. They think they're safe because they trust the celebrity.
Where do you go if you think that you've been a victim of a crypto crime?
Well, the first thing to do is stop sending money. So often, as I said, you get a double fraud. You've lost money and someone will go, I can get you this money back. I need this fee. Don't be doing that. Contact your bank. If you do it quickly, there might be some help there. You report it to Action Fraud. That's the government authority which tracks these things. I've spoken to Action Fraud, made films with them, and said, why can't you track these things down? And even when it's not Bitcoin, it's very hard to track it down and get your money back. When it is Bitcoin, I think the likelihood of them actually offering you help is small, I'm afraid, but it might help others because they could close down the scheme, avoid recovery agents, and keep all your screenshots and your emails and your messages, because that might help catch the criminals even if you can't get your money back.
Is there any way of being able to assess how safe a cryptocurrency is? Is there any kind of government-approved website that says these are the coins that we know are safe to buy? So not being scammed or anything like that, just to buy. How do we even know that?
Yeah, so I think there's a distinction here. There's no inherently safe coin, if you like. There are inherently unsafe coins. I can talk about that. But it's not that the coin or the investment is inherently unsafe. It is that the person who's trying to sell it to you is doing it in an unregulated space. And this is a largely unregulated area. So there is an inherent danger, if you like, for that. And that's why I think if you really aren't into cryptocurrencies and really understand the risks involved, not so much with the investment, because that's really easy to tell you. I've told you now, it's massively volatile, but there's money to be made. But if you don't know who you're trading with, I would stay out of that. In terms of your other point about, is there an inherently safe coin? There's lots of, Bitcoin is the most famous ones, but there are others. But there was one, for instance, called OneCoin, which was invented or run by, who became known as the Crypto Queen. She raised $4 billion through that from investors and more or less ran off with the money, took a Ryanair flight to Athens back in 2017, and has never been heard of since. That money has evaporated and she is now on the FBI's most wanted list. And so there are lots of examples of places which were unsafe, but I'm afraid I can't tell you, oh, this is the safe place to go. But it is appealing and lots of people are going there because there's money to be had in the legitimate trades.
The way that we looked at cryptocurrency a couple of years ago seems to be very different to the way that we looked at it now. Mm. And there seemed to be a feeling back then that eventually this would become a much more regulated, much easier to use form of money. You know, we'd be able to go into Marks and Spencer's and, you know, buy three pairs of pants with our Bitcoin. But it doesn't seem to have come to that.
Yeah. I mean, you could get a lot of pairs of pants for a bit of a Bitcoin unless you have exceptionally fancy pants. So, you know, that's always going to be a bit difficult. And there was a sort of attempt, I think, by Elon Musk, that sort of symbol of stability and prudency, to actually use Bitcoin. I think that's been much less the case now. But you're right, we are seeing a sort of move towards this. Central banks are now looking at this and going, maybe we should actually be involved in a big way. And in theory, at least, Bitcoin could argue it's more stable in that countries can just print the amount of pounds they want. So it could be inflationary. There is a limit to the amount of any particular cryptocurrency that can be created, mathematically a limit. So therefore, it stands outside what's called the fiat currencies, the currencies developed by countries, and therefore could be a way to stability. But it's not going to happen next year or anything like that. So it remains, I think it's fair to say, in many areas, a sort of Wild West area for investment and something to be exceptionally careful of.
One of our regular listeners has sent a graph of Bitcoin saying it's actually down 15% this year not up. But actually, the graph is hugely volatile, more volatile than stock market.
Yes, much more volatile. You're right. Down this year, it's 400% up in 5 years.
Okay.
And those are the sorts of terms. Look, there's investors and there's speculators. So, yes, down this year, 400% up in 5 years. And generally, I personally don't like looking at investment periods less than 5 years anyway. And there are other coins as well you can invest in. But in a time when you're looking at very volatile markets anywhere, this has the appeal. And I think, especially amongst the younger age groups, and I've been speaking to, I was at a school recently, where I was giving a talk to sixth formers, and the teachers were really worried, going, lots of them are turning up and going, oh, I don't need a degree because I'll just make my money out of Bitcoin. And these guys were just, they found it really exciting. It was like F1. You know, that was the sort of appeal. It was great. It was edgy. And they all queued up. And when I talked about buying a tracker in an ISA, no one was interested.
You surprised me, Adam.
But I had a long line of, generally, to be honest, young guys, not women, not girls, but young guys, lining up, they're going, yeah, the Bitcoins, and I've made that, and I'm not going to go work. I'm going to invest in Bitcoin. I'm going to buy a house, and that's what I'm going to do. And I was really pushing them to take a more sort of modest approach to their financial future. And the teachers were coming up to me and going, we're really worried because all these guys are on Facebook or on TikTok, and they're following what's called finfluencers, who are persuading them to do this. And the influence of finfluencers is now a major concern of the Bank of England.
And it is all part of what was started by Andrew Tate. The Hustlers University had exactly that kind of side hustle in just investing in schemes online that you weren't working towards. You probably never heard of them before, but it was very much the get-rich-quick thing. Yeah. Can I ask you such an ignorant question? Forgive me always. Yeah. But if you buy into a coin, a crypto coin, and it makes huge amounts of money, and then you sell it, is that regarded as a currency transaction or an investment transaction? Do you pay tax on the money you've made from
that? Yeah, it's a capital gain. If you've bought it at one price, whatever the asset is, and sell it at a higher price, you've made a capital gain. It's not a tax-exempt gain. I don't know of an ISA that has Bitcoin in it. Maybe listeners can tell me, but I've never certainly come across that. So it's a taxable gain like anything else.
Okay, that's very interesting to know. Do you think all of the right tax is being paid on it, Adam?
Well, that's another question, which you and Jane always ask me about those sorts of things. Of course, because it's untraceable, one might argue that there are people out there trading in these things and not making the proper declarations out of them.
Yes, one might assume that that's happening.
One might assume that that's happening. And that's, you know, this whole area opens up a whole thing for the dark web as well.
Adam, as always, thank you very much. Roya and I will be back tomorrow from 2. Our producer today was Rosie Cutler. Our technical operator was Ryan Boyden. My apologies, Elizabeth. You're absolutely right. It was Jane Eyre, wasn't it? Dear reader, I divorced him.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Fee. Thank you, Roy. 4 o'clock. I'm John Pienaar. This is Times Radio Drive, and here are the headlines. The Office for Budget Responsibility says last week's accidental release of the Chancellor's budget details was the worst failure in its 15-year history. And the Prime Minister's insisting the Chancellor didn't lie to the public when she said there was a black hole in the country's finances. And coming up, I'll be talking to Douglas Alexander from the Cabinet and a former special advisor to Gordon Brown about these developments. And also coming up, NATO bosses say the organisation is becoming more proactive, or needs to, as it changes its approach to preemptive strikes. Does that mean a more aggressive stance on Russia in cyber and other areas? I'll be talking to one of NATO's former generals.
This is Times Radio.
Now the news with James Kitchen.
Thank you, John. Good afternoon. The Treasury Minister says he's very concerned previous fiscal statements may have been publicly available on the Spending Watchdog's website. The Office for Budget Responsibility says last week's leak of the Chancellor's budget details was the worst failure in its 15-year history. In a report, the OBR concluded its forecast release was not intentionally leaked, nor a case of a button being pressed too early. It also found the leak was not the result of hostile cyber activity, but rather a publicly accessible URL address. Appearing in the Commons in the past few minutes, James Murray called the breach very serious.
On the morning of the budget, the first IP address to successfully access the EFO had made 32 prior attempts that day, starting at around 5 a.m. Such a volume of requests implies that the person attempting to access the document had every confidence that persistence would lead to success at some point. And this, unfortunately, leads us to consider whether the reason they tried so persistently to access the EFO is because they had been successful at a previous fiscal event.
The watchdog says a new publishing system must be in place by spring. 0% tariffs have been agreed on UK medicines exported to the US for at least 3 years. The government will also increase the upper threshold for which it can buy new medicines by 25%. It's hoped the new pharmaceuticals deal struck with Donald Trump's White House will get groundbreaking new treatments to hospitals quicker. The former minister, Tulip Siddiq, says she's the victim of a kangaroo court after being sentenced to 2 years in prison in Bangladesh. The Labour MP has been accused of obtaining land in the capital, Dhaka, by using her links to the ousted Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina, who's also her aunt. Ashfaq Zaman is the founder of CNI News Network in Bangladesh.
For us or for the court, she is not a British MP. She is not here convicted as a British MP. So her privileges, as she was mentioning, that there was no letter being sent in the House of Commons and other places, probably is not valid, because at the end of the day over here, she's just a regular citizen. And I think the due process that would have been followed for being a regular citizen over here probably was followed.
Volodymyr Zelensky says there are tough issues to work out as negotiators continue to work through a peace deal to end the war in Ukraine. The country's president has been meeting Emmanuel Macron in Paris before flying to Ireland. Earlier, four people were killed in a Russian missile attack on the city of Dnipro. An agency staff hired to cover bin workers on strike in Birmingham have now also walked out. The Unite Union claims the actions over allegations of bullying, harassment and the threat of blacklisting. Onay Kassab from the Unite Union admits it's costing a lot of money.
We pay strike pay of £70 a day. And of course, that doesn't match their pay, but we do pay £70 a day in strike pay. But look, as far as I'm concerned, when a union's got money, I can't think of a better way for that money to be spent than supporting workers who are defending their pay and conditions at work.
And for a news bulletin, when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on the Times radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. John Pienaar at Drive on Times Radio.
Hello, I'm John Pienaar with Drive on Times Radio. Thanks for joining me. Well now, Keir Starmer has leapt to the defence of his struggling Chancellor, which, given the PM's own plummeting popularity, may look to some a little bit like throwing a drowning woman a lead-lined lifebelt. Now, the Prime Minister insisted Rachel Reeves didn't lie to the Cabinet or the country about the hole in the public finances, even when she heard, it was actually a small surplus on the Treasury books. But failing to stand by his Downing Street neighbour would have looked, and surely been, a betrayal, since Keir Starmer was getting the same forecast that she was. And would it have made much difference if Rachel Reeves had given ministers a blow-by-blow update on the changing forecasts? Do chancellors ever share every decision taken on the budget to the entire cabinet? Gordon Brown didn't even tell Tony Blair what he was up to. And the outcome on this budget was the same. Millions of middle and higher earners were hit with higher taxes. Now, in this case, earlier today, Keir Starmer told a news conference that he, as well as she, was considering breaking Labour's manifesto and raising tax rates ahead of the budget. And he told everyone that he wanted Reeves to build up an extra £22 billion as a safeguard against the future. The Chancellor, of course we know, hit millions with higher taxes, and she pledged millions more in spending on welfare today. Starmer said he was proud of that. Now, maybe, by far, the real and most obvious porky was promising at election time not to raise taxes, and then doing it and denying it last week. But the Prime Minister and the Chancellor, as it is, will sink or swim together. And just now, they look to some as if they're more like sinking than swimming. Unless, of course, something turns up. Labour's and the country's luck changes. I wonder, are you in the forgiving mood about this? Who do you blame for this mess? Send me a text, 87222, start with the word Times, or a tweet to @TimesRadio. Let's just listen back and remind ourselves how Keir Starmer backed the Chancellor, saying neither he nor the Chancellor misled the public over the UK's finances before raising taxes. The Prime Minister defended the budget at an event earlier today.
There was no misleading, and I simply don't accept, and I was receiving the numbers, that being told that the OBR productivity review means you've got £16 billion less than you would otherwise have had, shows that you've got an easy starting point. Yes, of course, all the other figures have to be taken into account, but we started the process with significantly less than we would otherwise have had.
Well, the Prime Minister said he wanted to do more to double the headroom.
If we measured against our objectives, which is protecting public services, doing what we could on the headroom, which I really wanted to do this time for reasons that are well understood in terms of the stability that it gives, I wanted to more than double the headroom and to bear down on the cost of living, because I know that for families and communities across the country, that is the single most important issue. Wanted to achieve all those things, starting that exercise with £16 billion less than we might otherwise have had.
Well, we've just been hearing from the Treasury Minister, James Murray, in the House of Commons.
The Chancellor has been consistent and upfront with the public about her considerations in the lead-up to the budget last week. First, the Chancellor was clear on her priorities at the budget, which was to cut NHS waiting lists, to cut the cost of living, and to cut our debt and borrowing. The budget that she delivered last week delivered on those priorities. Secondly, the Chancellor was clear on November the 4th that a lower productivity forecast would mean lower tax receipts. The OBR confirmed at the budget that tax receipts are £16 billion lower as a result of their reduced productivity forecast. Third, the Chancellor was clear on November the 4th that she intended to build more headroom. She has done that, with a headroom against the stability rule at £21.7 billion.
So that was the Treasury Minister, James Murray, in the Commons just now. Let's just say hi to Oliver Wright, the Times policy editor. Hi to you, Oliver.
Hello.
Oliver, what's your assessment to where we are now, having heard the accusations and the government's answers?
It's tricky, isn't it? I mean, in some ways, the truth lies in the eye of the beholder. You know, there is clear evidence that Rachel Reeves was, you know,